this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
That doesn't excuse inaction or, you know, claiming, oh, we did all these great things for the environment and for those poor people of Bayview Hunters Point, quote unquote, when in fact that never happened.
Kamala Harris promised environmental justice in California, but it never materialized.
The students say, this is not normal. We should be able to go to school here, live here, work here, make our families here, and be patriotic Bangladeshi.
Former U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney recounts the colonial and neocolonial history of Bangladesh, leading to the current student-led mass upheaval.
This monitor is hostile to the UAW leadership as it exists, and he's hostile to the one member, one vote. So when you have someone pretending to be unbiased, having authority over the UAW, and then openly complaining that the UAW took a position on the war in Gaza, his bias is there.
A court-appointed monitor raises issues of corruption within the United Auto Workers and pressures the union not to take a stand in support of a ceasefire in Gaza. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. When serving as San Francisco District Attorney, Kamala Harris created the first DA's Environmental Justice Unit, but it prosecuted only the most trivial offenses in a neighborhood besieged by industrial and military pollution. She also failed to address environmental injustice as California Attorney General. Pacifica's Ann Garrison spoke to Bradley Angel of San Francisco-based Green Action for Health and Environmental Justice.
Bradley Angel, you couldn't seem to find anything more fraudulent than Kamala Harris's claim to have been an environmental champion in San Francisco Bayview Hunters Point, a majority-minority neighborhood that's been dumped on by all kinds of industrial polluters and the U.S. Navy, which left a radioactive dump site behind. Could you talk about that?
Sure. When Kamala Harris was district attorney, back in, I think it was 2005, that she established at the San Francisco DA's office what was called an environmental justice unit. And her statements at the time announcing and starting that initiative, it was actually sounded really great and much needed. Bayview Hunters Point is the picture postcard of environmental injustice, of environmental racism. And it was one of the first, if not the first, such, you know, environmental justice unit within a city and county DA's office in the country. So people, and, you know, I was working with, as I am today, working with folks in Bayview Hunters Point at the time on many of these issues. So we were heartened, but we never heard much more, if anything more. If it was done properly, if it actually lived up to its intentions and its mission, that would have been awesome. And it is so needed. You know, Bayview Hunters Point residents have suffered health disparities, you know, from asthma to cancer, heart problems, which a lot of even government agencies acknowledge is linked to the many pollution sources in the neighborhood. So there is a great need for, and continues to be a great need for, criminal prosecution and enforcement of the laws around pollution of this heavily impacted community. Looking back now, all we found is a couple of small potatoes. You know, she went after some really small-time folks, not the big industries that continue to pollute Bayview Hunters Point, not at the shipyard Superfund site that continues to be just scandalous. And it would have been nice for the district attorney, as well as when she was attorney general of California, to really take on these polluters in Bayview Hunters Point. That just never happened.
Well, didn't she go after, say, a printer who was dumping some toxic ink, some barrels of toxic ink, and then an auto shop that was producing fraudulent smog records on cars that had to do their smog check?
Well, that's what we understand. And again, it's appropriate to, you know, enforce the laws when it comes to people's, you know, things, activities that affect people's health or threaten people's health. But to make that the target, right? So some small-time folks trying to make a living, there's ways to deal with that, but don't claim that that's the main focus of a so-called environmental justice unit. For example, at the Port of San Francisco, there's major, in Bayview Hunters Point, there's major industries that have been operating without permits, that have been emitting harmful pollution into the air of Bayview Hunters Point without proper permits or proper environmental studies for decades. Nothing happened to take them on. You know, she certainly did nothing around the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard Superfund site, either as DA or as state attorney general. And why that is, she's going to have to answer to that. It could be that she has friends such as former Mayor Willie Brown, who's actually ended up working for the Lennar Five Points Shipyard luxury development. So I can't read her mind, but what we do know for a fact is that the so-called district attorney's environmental justice unit did not take on the big polluters, did not take on the scandalous activities and flawed cleanup at the shipyard.
Tell us about that real estate corporation, the Lennar Corporation, which has close ties to then Mayor Gavin Newsom, now Governor Gavin Newsom, and political kingmaker Willie Brown, who launched Kamala Harris's political career. Tell us about their real estate project in Bayview Hunters Point on the radioactive naval shipyard, the radioactive shipyard that the Navy left behind.
Right. Well, the Navy actually still has it, and they're trying to dump it in and declare that parcel by parcel are clean, but they're not. So Lennar Corporation, one of the biggest developers in the United States, you know, worked with the city and county of San Francisco several decades ago. And at the time, in fact, Green Action and a group called Power sued the city over that and the inadequate environmental review. And the battle has continued. So Lennar's plan, and today it's Five Points, a spinoff, plans to build and hopes to build more than 10,000 additional, mostly luxury houses at an inadequately and incompletely cleaned Hunters Point Shipyard Superfund site that they hope the governor will declare is clean, give it to the city, who will give it to their buddies at Lennar. You know, one parcel had been deemed clean quite a few years ago, and it was called Parcel A up on the hill, right, where the Navy and the federal and state agencies and City Hall said, oh, it couldn't possibly be contaminated, even though it's part of the shipyard. And the whistleblower said, oh, yes, it is. And people I know, who actually one person who was involved in the cleanup, but not from Tetra Tech EC, they told us about the extensive contamination there. So hundreds of luxury condos have now been built on the hill at the first parcel that was incorrectly deemed clean. And they never tested under the homes. They never tested under the children's playground. And when they were forced to do some testing a couple of years ago, what do you know? They found radioactive object right next to, you know, the homes. So, and there's a big push to deem the other parcels clean. I am glad to say that back on June 28th, Green Action sued the Navy and EPA about the inadequate cleanup and inadequate testing of the shipyard Superfund site. And about 2 weeks ago now, the Navy gave in on some of the retesting issues. So we have our first victory on that, and it clearly pushes the development back. So that's where we're at. But, you know, we didn't see and continue not to see the DA's office actively involved in forcing a better cleanup. And certainly when Harris was state attorney general, to my knowledge, she did absolutely nothing on that issue.
Wasn't the building causing the release of toxins into the air, Bayview Hunters Point?
Yeah, in fact, there was quite a few years ago, there was an incident where there was a underground chemical fire that would burn, you know, on and on. And we also know that air monitors have been turned off at points. And it's a really difficult situation. I want to say that even if you and I, right, people who actually care and had that, if we had that super technical expertise, it would be a challenge to properly and fully clean up that site. They have to do better. But the plan has never been for a full cleanup. It has been to do a partial cleanup, leave toxic and radioactive waste buried at the shoreline of San Francisco Bay at the shipyard, where it will be underwater in, you know, years or decades, spreading the contamination further into the bay and into Bayview Hunters Point. And so we're making progress in that. You know, the community has been fighting around this for decades, Green Action standing, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the community. But Bayview Hunters Point has not gotten the help they need on any of these issues from City Hall all the way up.
And doesn't Bayview Hunters Point have one of the highest, if not the highest, breast cancer rate in the country?
Well, a number of years ago, that was apparently the case. And you know, it's no surprise. Bayview Hunters Point, again, has industrial polluters operating at the port of San Francisco. Two freeways, you know, surround the neighborhood, the sewage treatment plant, the infamous Hunters Point Shipyard Superfund site, many other brownfield sites, contaminated sites, heavy freight, diesel freight traffic. So, yeah, there's even today, unlike when I first started this work in the late 80s, today, all the government agencies from City Hall to the Bay Area Air District to the state of California and the US EPA all acknowledge Bayview Hunters Point ranks way up there as one of the most impacted communities and vulnerable communities in the entire state of California.
Okay, so in this super toxic neighborhood, Kamala Harris went after some publisher dumping toxic ink in some barrels in some parking lot, and someone falsifying their smog check tests at an auto shop. But then she produced advertisements in which she claimed that that was a big environmental achievement.
Yeah, I mean, we have an elected official whose job is to enforce the laws. And you know, yeah, I'm not a big fan of the mainstream political parties in our country, and I think one is worse than the other. But that doesn't excuse inaction or claiming, oh, we did all these great things for the environment and for those poor people of Bayview Hunters Point, quote unquote, when in fact that never happened.
Well, there's one thing I can't help mentioning before leaving the subject of Bayview Hunters Point. Lawrence Pelosi, who is, I believe, Nancy Pelosi's nephew, became Gavin Newsom's campaign treasurer when he was running for mayor the first time. And he came from the Lennar Corporation's Southwest Acquisitions Unit. And after then Mayor Newsom's first victory, after he became the mayor of San Francisco, that's when the Lennar development took off in Bayview Hunters Point, right?
Yes. I mean, again, it's quite a nefarious connections and relationships, right? So all the, you know, the main elected officials, you know, locally, state and feds, and including the ex-mayor, Willie Brown, who really was responsible for really starting this and then went to work selling investments in the shipyard development. I mean, it stinks, literally. And this is why Green Action and residents continue to fight against whomever in power to ensure that there is the best possible cleanup to the extent humanly possible. We also, at Green Action, we don't want to see Bayview Hunters Point gentrified either. It should be cleaned up, and the health and the different environmental, social, economic injustices, remedied. But we want to see Bayview Hunters Point cleaned up for the people of Bayview Hunters Point, not for millionaires who would move in.
Okay, and what about her record as California Attorney General? What can you tell us about that?
From, again, I think it's a mixed record. It's a little better than when she was at DA in terms of environmental enforcement. She actually did take on some big pollution problems and not just, some mom and pop operations. So she actually did take on some bigger, targets, which is good. I don't think she did enough. And she, again, did nothing about the Hunters Point Shipyard. One of the unreported stories, and I think improper or failure to uphold her duties as Attorney General, was there's a farm worker community in the Central Valley of California called Kettleman City. Okay. And down the I-5, halfway from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Okay. And if you make a left and go a mile, it's the dusty farm worker town of Kettleman City. If you go to the right, 2 miles, is the biggest hazardous waste landfill in the West. And over the years, that landfill, the toxic dump, has been allowed to operate based on improperly issued permits that were issued with straight up racially discriminatory processes, English only permit processes, enforced by police intimidation and harassment of residents. So about, I think it was the end of 2014, Green Action filed, and the community group El Pueblo of Kettleman City, we filed an administrative federal and state civil rights complaint against the State Department of Toxics and California EPA for approving the expansion of the landfill using these straight up racial discriminatory processes. It was so bad that the United States EPA actually accepted our federal Title VI civil rights complaint for investigation within weeks, the quickest they ever did. It was so clear. And we had submitted one to the state attorney general to uphold state civil rights laws. We never heard back for months and months and months. And then I get a call from Kamala Harris's office saying, oh, we understand you filed a state civil rights complaint with our office. Can you resend it? We can't find it. Problem number one. I resend it. And we had certainly got it to them in a timely fashion right from the start. Ultimately, I get a letter signed by Kamala Harris saying, I'm just paraphrasing that, as her office represents the parties we filed the complaint against, she couldn't do anything. And what that told us, in a nutshell, is that there was no enforcement mechanism for civil rights violations in California at the time. She didn't say, the letter didn't say, oh, contact this person or contact that agency. It was just, you know, take it easy. And thank goodness. And I was honestly and pleasantly shocked that the feds took it much more seriously. And it actually resulted in a landmark federal civil rights settlement with the state agencies. But nothing of the sort happened under Kamala Harris's watch at the state level.
Let me make sure I understand this. She told you that the California Attorney General's office represented the polluters in Kettleman
City?
No,
not the polluters. It was a complaint filed against the State Department of Toxics and California EPA. And the Attorney General does represent those state agencies.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But she also represents the people of the state of California. And if there's civil rights violations, we believe that she has an obligation to do something about it. And instead, she just months and months and months later, after trying to ignore it, except it started getting a lot of, you know, attention, she just said, oh, sorry, can't do anything about it. We represent the, you know, people you're complaining about, period.
So you were complaining that the state agencies hadn't done anything about Kettleman City?
That, well, they had done plenty, which is illegally approved a permit using straight up racial discrimination and police intimidation.
Okay.
And clearly illegal, as I think the EPA, US EPA accepting our federal complaint, really quicker than any other similar complaint ever in the country. And after 7 months of federal mediation, we reached a settlement with the state agencies, but no thanks to Kamala Harris.
Okay. And what about her claims to have gone after big oil?
There was some, you know, I'm not 100% familiar with everything she did or did not do, but she did go after some bigger cases. And I think that's a good thing. Could she have done more? I'm sure she could have. So at least I'd say the record was a little better on that end than it was at the DA's Environmental Justice Unit, so-called EJ unit.
Well, she claimed to have sued ExxonMobil for lying about climate change, for lying about its impact on climate change. And according to PolitFact, that never happened. Are you familiar with it?
I did not know it never happened, but I wouldn't doubt it. In the same way that the alleged rigorous environmental justice legal, you know, action of the DA's office just never happened.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say about Kamala Harris's environmental record?
Yeah, I would. Very important. You know, here we are today, right? We have a presidential election coming up, and Green Action does not endorse or oppose candidates for office. So I want to make that really clear. Her rhetoric, much of it over the last couple of years around environment and environmental justice, a lot of it, not all, has been positive, has been acknowledging the reality of environmental injustice, of climate change, of the need for environmental, climate, and racial justice. That's a good thing. The Biden-Harris administration has done some good things on these issues, and then some not so good things, including, I would say, promoting a increased domestic uranium reserve, which means that there would be more uranium mining, more nuclear, and dumping of the uranium tailings at the one uranium mill in the United States, which just happens to be, no surprise, next to an impoverished Native American community in southern Utah that Green Action works with, the White Mesa Ute community of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe. And so here's the Biden-Harris administration promoting more of, you know, the push for uranium and kind of forgetting about the environmental justice, the indigenous rights issue of that. You know, she seems to be, we're hearing she may be reversing her position on fracking, which is very unfortunate, but I'm not surprised. This is what the Democratic Party does. So these are things that people are pressuring the White House on, not, you know, not so much as a candidate, but, you know, the White House. I know she's going to be called out. I was just at, a few days ago, the Indigenous Environmental Networks Protecting Mother Earth Conference, and a lot of people were talking about her position on fracking being changed. So we're real concerned. So Green Action and a lot of others will be holding her accountable and calling her out as needed.
Okay, Bradley Angel, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thanks, Anne, and thanks, Pacifica Radio. Take care.
That was Bradley Angel of San Francisco-based Green Action for Health and Environmental Justice speaking to Pacifica's Anne Garrison.
War, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. Our things ain't what they used to be. Lost more radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby us die.
That was Marvin Gaye, Mercy, Mercy Me. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina resigned from her post and left the country for India after nearly 2 months of violent unrest. 84-year-old banker and scholar Muhammad Yunus, a favorite of the U.S., has reportedly agreed to serve as leader of the military-controlled government. J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio spoke with former presidential candidate and former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney about the colonial and neocolonial history and current context of the student-led upheaval.
We're getting very little information about what is happening in Bangladesh. Can you just tell us a little bit about your life in Bangladesh and what is your understanding as to what is happening in Bangladesh right now?
Well, I first came to Bangladesh in 2014, and I have to tell you that I came here on a speaking engagement, and I basically didn't return to the U.S. because the mission of the university at which I teach was just so fabulous to me that they wanted to, well, what the Board of Trustees members, when giving me the tour, told me that no Bangladeshi should ever have to leave their country in order to get a world-class education. And so they help Bangladeshis to integrate with the world by bringing the information technology from the rest of the world to Bangladesh. It's a fabulous model. And the language of instruction is English, so that makes it very easy for me. And so basically, I found a home here. There's no more hospitable a people than the Bangladeshi people. Their foreign policy motto is friendship to all and malice toward none. And I think if you were to investigate the history of the foreign policy of the People's Republic of Bangladesh, that's what you would find, that they have tried to make friends and be friendly in the rest of the world. And I can tell you also that domestically, I mean, of course, there's crime and there's poverty and there are these sorts of things, but Bangladesh for the last 10 or maybe 15 years has been a country on the move because the vibrant economy is such that you've got these hardworking people and they are entrepreneurial. And so you've got all of the makings. If you could get rid of neoliberalism and neocolonialism, you've got all of the makings of a developing state that is also developing in its sovereignty and its independence. Of course, in this part of the world, you've got the Chinese model, what is known of the Chinese model, let's put it that way, because there are many aspects of the Chinese model that cannot be replicated by other countries. But you've got the focus on eliminating dire poverty, which is what the Chinese model basically stands for. And so you've got that model that's very close to here, just a few countries away. And the Chinese are very interested in Bangladesh. Unfortunately, so too is the United States. And probably maybe about 20 years ago, the United States expressed an interest in establishing a military base here. And the government at that time said no. And every once in a while, this comes up again as a political issue that the U.S., you know, maybe says something behind the scenes, intimating that they're still interested in getting access to that military base, which the people of Bangladesh, the people don't want it. And so that's why it hasn't happened. Okay, so now let's kind of fast forward to what the situation is in Bangladesh and in many of the formerly colonized countries that exist in this neo-colonized and neoliberal world. So basically what I want to explain to you is what Catherine Austin Fitz came and visited me here in Bangladesh. And after she went to classes with me and after sort of observing the situation and observing the students here, she came up with a characterization that I think is particularly apt. And she called it the great culling machine. So I want to talk to you, and this is what I teach my students, about how they are destined to be a part of the great culling machine unless they say no to all of the enticements and the rewards that the neoliberal international economic structure can offer them. So here's how the great culling machine works. So you go to school and you perform because the pressure to perform, you know, all of the students, you wouldn't believe how they care about their GPA, their grade point average. And, you know, that's sort of like all they talk about. It's a totally different environment and mindset here as opposed to what we might experience in the United States. So anyway, you've got this intensely competitive environment where students are trying to outdo one another so they can get the highest grade point average. And then with a high grade point average, well, you know, sort of the world kind of opens up to them so they can get jobs in the private sector. But the interesting thing is they can't get jobs in the public sector, which is what I'm going to get to. So if they can't get jobs in the public sector, and then if for some reason the opportunity, say, for example, in family businesses or whatever, that, you know, the family members get the first dibs, then there's not so much opportunity to get job in the private sector, then what does this student have to do? Well, basically, it's kind of expected that you'll leave Bangladesh. So Bangladeshis are paying for a educational system that doesn't really benefit Bangladesh because the students go to, a lot of them go to the UK because this was a colony of England, of Great Britain, United Kingdom. And so they go there, they go to the United States, which of course gets the main benefit. But it's almost like in ABB, any place but Bangladesh. And so they leave Bangladesh and then they help to build other countries. So they will settle in. You have lots and lots and lots of computer engineers. So if they come to the United States, they'll settle in Silicon Valley, or they can also be healthcare providers, and they'll settle in the United States in the professions. And they'll do that, but they leave behind their family, their friends, their community, their language, and their culture. So they end up sending what are called remittances back to Bangladesh for family support. And this is not just true of the Bangladeshis that leave. This is true of all of the people in the formerly colonized world that are looking to try and find a place, someplace that would benefit their talents, and it's not at home. So you end up getting Nigerians coming to the United States. This is sort of the way the West continues, is through globalization, that the West continues to strip the resources from these developing countries. And this is a part of the system. This is the way the system is built. So whether it's your brain or it's your brawn, that goes outside of your country. And so your country doesn't benefit from either your brain or your brawn. Other countries do. So right. You'll see a lot of Bangladeshis in Qatar. You'll see a lot of Bangladeshis in United Arab Emirates. You'll see them in Malaysia. And you've heard Bangladeshis even walking across the U.S. border from Mexico. So you've heard about these Bangladeshis that leave Bangladesh.
Right.
Their entire polity and their economy are built on Bangladeshis leaving. One, you get the remittances. Those remittances then come back to the country, and the country counts that as income. And so that goes then in the ledger for income to the country. Then on the other hand, not only the remittances, that's the economic pull that the country has for establishing this kind of a model and sort of embedding this model into its development model, its development policies itself. But then what happens is the best and the brightest minds are not inside the country. They're outside of the country.
Right, a brain drain.
Now what happens is the country, the state, the politics of the country is left to those who are not the best and the brightest. Okay, so now it's very difficult under this scenario. It's very difficult for the country to develop in the way that people want their country to develop. And so then there's a push and then there's a pull. The best and the brightest and those who work the hardest with the brawn, pushing them out, but also these other countries, Malaysia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, the United States, they also pull these Bangladeshis. So now, suppose you have a movement where the students say, this is not normal. We should be able to go to school here, live here, work here, make our families here, and be patriotic Bangladeshis. Now imagine then what will happen. Well, you're going to turn the politics on its head because now you've got generations and generations of people who have benefited from the departure of these people from the country. And they have become sort of the status quo leaders.
Right.
So
elite.
Now what you've got is these students that are saying, because Bangladesh has this unique history of, in the very beginning, it was a part of India. And then when the British left, it was a part of Pakistan. And then India and Israel joined forces to balkanize Pakistan. And in 1971, Bangladesh was created. So you've got this kind of political, well, I wouldn't necessarily call it instability, but you've got this political experience in this part of the world that you also have to contend with. Okay, so now because of the fight against Pakistan with the help of Israel and India, you have the people who did the fighting are called freedom fighters. And this is back in 1971. So the government of Bangladesh instituted a quota system that gives a preference to the freedom fighters, that gave a preference to the freedom fighters. Then, as circumstances changed, that quota system was enlarged to include women. And then the quota system was enlarged again to include indigenous peoples who are unfairly treated, and the policy is to try and mainstream them into the politics and the economy. And then you've got disabled people. The quota system was enlarged again for disabled people. So this quota system, then when the freedom fighters died out, then their children succeeded in becoming beneficiaries. And now it's their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. And the quota system grew so that a minority of those who didn't fall into any category could be considered on their merit, which basically perpetuated this perverse system where the best and brightest or the strongest, they always leave and go and build other countries. And so they call it the Student Movement for Non-Discrimination. And the purpose is quota reform so that the students who represent the best and brightest that is produced by Bangladeshi schools get access to jobs in Bangladesh.
Right.
And that's not very much to ask for.
Well, it's being said in the West that it is a revolution. The word revolution is being used in reference to what's going on in Bangladesh. Is that how the people on the ground see it?
Well, I think a lot of eyes have been opened because of the very ugly and violent way that the government responded. And so students were actually murdered. Students were murdered by the police. And then a particular minister called out the thugs and told the thugs that pledged their allegiance to this political party, told the thugs that they could run the streets. And then even more students who were protesting, even more of the protesters were murdered. So we've got a situation now. Now, see, I've been here before in other student protest movements, and there was one before that could easily have turned into a revolutionary situation. And it didn't, because the aims of the students, the demands of the students remained in education as opposed to spilling over into the political sphere. This time, however, the demands are still basically not political, but just, you know, sort of access to equal opportunity to get a job if you perform well in your academic career. But because of the way that the government reacted, it very well could spill over. And let me just give you an example. One example is that this one student was quoted as saying, "This is not just about quota reform. What this shows us is that we need country reform." So now, I don't know how widespread that is within the organization of this, specifically for the student movement for non-discrimination. But if that's sort of the feeling on the periphery, then you definitely have the ingredients that are necessary for a revolutionary situation. So it could happen because, you see, there is the government of Bangladesh is showing itself to be not just corrupt. It's corrupt, but not just corrupt, but a kakistocracy. Inept.
A what?
Unqualified.
A what? What
did inept. You call it? A kakistocracy. And this is also one of the concepts that I teach. I teach about the great culling machine, and I give examples, and I let the students, more importantly, I let the students give example of how the great culling machine works in Bangladesh. So, you know, like, for example, you get perversions because of colonialism, neocolonialism, globalization, that's basically one way, and neoliberalism, you get these economic perversions. So, for example, the best job in Bangladesh that a Bangladeshi can have is to work for British American Tobacco. Well, what does British American Tobacco produce? It produces cigarettes that kill Bangladeshis, and that's the best job that's considered by Bangladeshis to be the best place to work. So you've got all of these, you could call them colonialisms, you know, the manifestations of neocolonialism or manifestations of how neoliberalism and globalization work against these countries, third world, so-called third world countries. And Bangladesh is a good example of that, of just that.
Well, definitely we're running out of time, but I wanted to thank you for this introductory update. We definitely got to come back to you and get updated some more as to what's going on, because there's very little information coming out of mainstream media or even progressive media in the United States about Bangladesh. In part, I'm sure to, you know, help cover U.S. interests, but I'm also sure that it's not too many media outlets that know a whole lot about Bangladesh. So thank you for the insight, and we will be talking to you soon.
As always, it's a pleasure.
Well, thank you. And how can people keep up with you?
Well, right now, we've got an internet. the whole country is on lockdown. And we've got curfew. We've got no access to internet. We've got no access to cell phones. I'm surprised that we were able to get through this. So right now, people can follow me on Twitter, but it won't be updated because I don't have access to that. My website, I don't have access to that either. I guess I could put something up right quick, right now, while I still have some signal.
Right. Well, thank you for spending this time with us and educating us. And, you know, keep your fist to the sky. We appreciate you. We support you, and we behind you.
All right. Thank you, JR.
That was Cynthia McKinney speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio before Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina was ousted from power. Despite the reality of the student movement's grievances, it appears that the National Endowment for Democracy has been working behind the scenes to support the opposition to the former prime minister. Journalist and analyst K.J. No, speaking on Sputnik Radio's Political Misfits, discussed the possible role of the U.S. behind the military's appointment of Muhammad Yunus as the country's transitional leader. Yunus is known as the, quote, banker to the poor, end quote, for founding the global microcredit movement.
It's not highly credible that a group of students could bring down a government in such a short time. We do know that the NED has been pouring millions of dollars to NGO groups in Bangladesh, $4 million in 2021 alone. But that in itself, you know, is necessary but not sufficient. But we can note U.S. demands to conduct quote-unquote, a fair election, U.S. challenges to the recent election outcomes, and then U.S. warnings not to crack down on protesters, and then a massive crackdown by the very forces, that is to say the military, that are now claiming to form an interim government to render justice, and then immediate favorable media coverage of the protests, and then you know, this looks very much like it's coming out of the U.S. regime change handbook. In particular, remember, the U.S. controls the backbone of the internet and the social media companies. If they wanted to put a brake on the protests, they could do that immediately. They could just get Facebook or Twitter to pull the kill switch. They didn't do that. And so all of that, in my opinion, is dispositive of U.S. string pulling. But let's think a little bit about Yunus. Yunus is, you know, he's never had any electoral success or really any experience as a political leader. He's just been essentially a banker, an economist, and a professor. So the call for him to lead the interim government is already highly suspect. But it starts to take on another dimension when you realize that Yunus is a U.S. favorite. You know, he had a Fulbright scholarship. Anybody who knows about Fulbright scholarships in the third world, you know that that's where the CIA screens for potential bright young future prospects. He had U.S. training, U.S. university positions and tenure, U.S. connections, U.S. Medals of honor, presidential and congressional. And most importantly, he reinforces U.S. geoeconomic policy with microlending. I mean, the pretext of microlending is that you're going to do poverty alleviation by saddling the poor with more debt. Now, that already is wrong-headed. But essentially what you're doing is you're kind of introducing debt into the poorer sectors of society. It's like a granular micro IMF for the really, really poor. And it has the results that you would expect. It's like you're fracking. You're debt fracking the poorest people on the planet, and then you're forcing them to pay back or commit suicide or take out new loans. It's a form of micro loan sharking, and it is extraordinarily, you know, vicious, but it fits in the logic of this kind of palliation of capitalist contradiction. It's the barrel scraping logic that you find where you simply go down further and further, more and more granular, and you try and squeeze every last drop of profit using your rentier extraction method, which is what loan sharking is. It's essentially you're squeezing the teat even when it's dry, and you're squeezing it from the poorest of the poor. You're taking it literally, you know, from starving babies. And this is why the ruling imperial neoliberal class loves him. You know, he was named and described favorably in WikiLeaks documents. You can see that the U.S. Consul General is sussing him out for potential. Now it seems like his time has come. He's come of age. So I think he's definitely the favorite. It's very strange that these students who are supposed to have Islamist propensities are asking for Mr. Microfinance, because remember...
Right. I mean, that is funny.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of odd.
It's odd, isn't it? Because, you know, microfinance is not halal. You know, it's usury.
That was journalist and analyst KJ No speaking on Sputnik Radio's Political Misfits. That was the Bangladeshi band Black singing Sheje Boshe Ache. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. The U.S. court-appointed monitor of the United Auto Workers Union, Neil Barofsky, has raised issues of corruption with UAW President Sean Fain. At the same time, Barofsky has tried to coerce the UAW not to take a position supporting a ceasefire in Gaza. He sent an Anti-Defamation League statement to the UAW Executive Board opposing the ceasefire demand. UAW Local 12 Jeep member George Windau spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
I worked at Jeep. I was still employed. I didn't retire until April of this year. But I and some other activists supporting Sean Fain and the Members United slate were campaigning around town at Dana, of course, at Jeep where we worked. But we also went over to a General Motors, it's called General Motors Propulsions. They do drivetrains, build drivetrains for GM products. And we had problems at one out at the Dana outlet. So they said that we were littering when we were passing out flyers and they were going to call the cops. So and we tried to talk to their HR officer, but they wouldn't let us. So I went to General Motors with the idea that I would get permission or at least find out what their rules are and get a written copy so that we could follow those rules. But to my astonishment, when I went to the guard shack and talked to a woman named Julie Burst, who was a security officer, she said that she had to call Local 14. Now, and they said, Local 14 said, no, we're not allowed to pass out flyers in the parking lot when the shift changes. Now, this is in February of 2023. It was probably February 6th or thereabout. It was the weather was not always favorable to us. So we're hoping to pass out flyers. The 6th was a Monday. We were hoping to pass out flyers by Thursday or Friday if the weather permitted. But when Julie Burst said Local 14 says you're not allowed to do that, I said, no, wait a minute. You're misreading the situation. This is not Local 14 property. This is General Motors property. I need to talk to the HR officer and get their policy on passing out literature. Well, she gave me the number. I called, and it turns out the woman's name is Susan Guthrow. And she never returned my call until Thursday the 9th. And she told me that no one who does not work at that General Motors factory is allowed to pass out literature on their property, including the parking lot area where workers park and come in and go out of the gates. And I said, well, can I get that in writing? She said, no, you can't. And I said, well, what happens if I violate your unwritten rule and come out and pass out flyers in favor of electing Sean Fain, since it's a national campaign? And she said, if you do that, we will call law enforcement. Now, she didn't say that I would be arrested, but I think I made a fair inference that she intended to arrest me or anyone who was with me to pass out flyers in the parking lot as workers came in and out at the shift change. So rather than get arrested or see any of my friends get arrested, We declined, but I called the monitor to complain, and they gave me an email, so I sent the email. And then I called the National Labor Relations Board about this. And they said, well, there's nothing in the law that guarantees your right to participate in union elections. So I said, okay. And then I find out 6 days later, a friend of mine who worked at General Motors Propulsion sent me a screenshot of Ray Curry, who was Sean Fain's opponent, passing out literature, shaking hands, and greeting the workers at the shift change. And this is on or about February 14th or 15th. I'm not sure which date, but it was about 6 days later. So when that happened, I immediately informed the monitor, Mr. Borofsky's office. He called it the election team. And I also filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board. They assigned me to a woman named Megan Sobczak, who immediately told me the companies have a right to show favoritism in any election that they want. And I said, oh, really? Well, what do you mean they show favoritism? It's their private property. Don't you understand that? On their private property, they can do anything they want with regard to elections. And I said, isn't this an unfair labor practice that they allow one candidate to campaign but not another? So finally, my charge at the labor board was put at active. And as soon as the active charge was sent to the General Motors office, I got the news that Susan Guthrow had been fired. So I don't know if it's because of my actions with the labor board, but I assumed that that was possible. But now we are 1 year and a half from filing both the complaint with the election team of Neil Borofsky and the National Labor Relations Board, and they have done nothing. They have never said, yes, you have a good case and you we're going to rule in your favor. And they have not said, no, you have no good case and we're dismissing your charge. They have said neither. All they will say is it's active. That's the labor board. Now, with Neil Borofsky, they have said nothing.
And Neil Borofsky has said that he's doing oversight. He is doing oversight. Neil Borofsky, as you say, sent a statement by the ADL to the executive board around the issue of Palestine. What does that have to do with corruption?
Boy, you got me. I don't understand it either. All I can say is that this guy has some attitudes, and he has his idea of what the UAW should be. When we want to talk about UAW being under the control of the monitor, this monitor is hostile to the UAW leadership as it exists, and he's hostile to the one member, one vote. So when you have someone pretending to be unbiased, having authority over the UAW, and then openly complaining that the UAW took a position on the war in Gaza, his bias is there. He's the emperor with no clothes on. That's what Neil Borofsky is. And the union members should know that. Now, I assume that Mr. Trump is going to keep attacking Sean Fain. And I assume that the Detroit News and Detroit Free Press and all the news media will continue to say that Sean Fain is corrupt. Why not call him a bank robber? I mean, that would really show corruption. But see, they don't have any proof. They have no proof. But I do. I do. And that's what I'm trying to get out, to point out that this captured agency called the NLRB Region 8 and Mr. Borofsky are against the direction that our unions are going, and I'm cheering us on.
That was Toledo UAW Local 12 Jeep member George Windau speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, J.R. Valray, Ann Garrison, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.